Meandering in the margins of medicine, it's the Short Coat Podcast.
Weird news,
fresh views,
helpful clues and interviews
by students for students.
Subscribe to our weekly show at theshortcoat.com.
Welcome back to the Short Coat Podcast.
These microphones.
They're terrible.
Oh my goodness.
They're awful. I just want to remind our viewers. First of all, I want to apologize to our viewers because nobody can hear me, which may or may not be a good thing. I want to remind our viewers about our voicemail contest. I'd like to give away some Starbucks gift cards. And the only way I can do that is if you call into our voicemail, 347-SHORT-CT. I almost said 1-800.
That's misleading.
That's very presumptuous of us.
Guys, it's actually a 1-900 number.
No.
Yes. 347-SHORT-CT. That's 347-some other number. 347-SHORT-CT.
Maybe they're afraid we're going to give them a head scan if they call in for a CT.
If you leave us a story of some sort, it'd be nice if it was a true story, I guess. Leave us a story about your day, something that happened to you. Leave us a message and make sure you leave your email address, of course, so that I can get in touch with you. I promise to do nothing else with it. Certainly not publish it on the internet.
No one would ever do that.
And I'll send you a gift card if I pick yours. For that honor. For that deep honor.
Does anybody else hear, like, excessive external voices, or is that a personal problem?
I think it's there are external voices.
Okay.
You know, this is a living building. This is a place where people live and work and play.
I can make them stop living if they're being too loud.
We don't need to do that. They're lovely people going about their lives. I want to know, you guys. So I went on as I often do for some reason.
Wait, Dave, who are we?
Oh yeah, I'm sorry.
I don't know who I am until you tell me.
It's Casey McCleary.
Whoa.
It's Allison Pletch. It's John Pienta.
Hello.
I apologize. That's very rude.
It was almost Corey the intern, but then we took his mic away.
Yeah, sorry, Corey. Here's what I want to know about you guys this week. So I went to studentdoctor.net, as I sometimes do when I'm casting about for ideas on what to talk about, and I read this these fears by a spouse, actually, or no, a girlfriend of a medical student who is concerned that the MD lifestyle, the MD spouse lifestyle specifically, was not for her. In terms of things like her worries about whether her future spouse was going to be around to raise kids, whether her future spouse was going to make enough money, whether her future spouse was going to be inevitably pulled into some sort of infidelity.
Because hospitals are so sexy.
They are sexy. That's what I've noticed. Whenever I walk through the hospital, I feel the sexy.
Yeah.
I think a lot of this person's perceptions of what was reasonable were sort of ridiculous. But at the same time, she did raise a couple of things that made me think, like, you know, would a spouse be able to, say, count on having somebody to help raise the children? Are the expectations of things like pay and lifestyle that even you guys have, not just spouses, but even you guys have, are they realistic? So that's what I want to talk about this week. This person's obviously a little crazy, like all people apparently on studentdoctor.net are. You should tell me not to go there anymore.
But it's so entertaining.
It is kind of entertaining.
It's just like a slow motion train wreck.
What is going on up there? Who slams the door?
A slow motion train wreck.
Who slams the door like 10 times?
The 10 different people going out into the hallway.
Into the same hallway. Let's start with the expectations you guys have. What are the expectations you guys have? So everybody here is in a relationship.
Yes.
Correct? So
I hope I still am.
What do you think your boyfriend's spouse's expectations are for the amount of time that you have available to them? John.
I don't want to get in trouble for saying it on air.
I think it's pretty clearly laid out. My wife is extremely gracious to me and is very understanding with my time. That being said, I try to spend as much time as I can with her and my baby.
Yeah, so there's a trying that goes on. I mean, you try to spend as much time as possible.
Yeah, I try to spend as little time studying as possible.
Okay.
And as much time possible with my
son. That's what I like
son.
About John. He's very articulate.
Yeah.
Are there times when you're like, no, I can't. I just can't right now. Honey, I know you really want me to do this, but I can't.
Nope. No, only when I'm like actually in clinic or something. Like my son had two doctor's appointments yesterday in the pediatric specialties clinic, and I was scheduled to take an end of clerkship test. So I just blasted through it as fast as I could, and then I went and met him at the clinic, and he got some blood drawn and
did your thing.
Yeah.
I turned down the volume, not to be
distracted by the sound issues.
I know, it's pretty ridiculous. I turned some things down. Maybe this will help. What about you, Allison?
I have a fiance, and we have been together throughout med school, but in a long distance relationship.
You're gonna present a bit of a skewed perception here.
I actually think it was great training for a future relationship where you don't see each other very often. I think that we worked out a lot of common problems that can come up in both long distance relationships and potentially relationships where one person is working a lot and the other may or may not be a stay-at-home dad. So I don't know. I'm not too worried about it because I feel like we've had a lot of practice. So take that for what it's worth. Maybe I'm totally naive.
That's brilliant. That's a brilliant strategy. Don't engage in anything but a long distance relationship.
I think
you can mail your children back and forth.
I think these stuff like that. I think trials in relationships. I think they tend to bring people. They bring you to sort of a fork in the road, and you either. I think it either makes you stronger for having come up with a solution together, like as a team, and put it forth and made it work, I think it heads things south pretty quickly.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think you're being naive, but medicine you didn't ask my opinion, so
medicine is good.
So I will render
your relationship.
What about you, Casey?
I've been with my partner since college, since our sophomore year of college, like 5 years, which is still weird that we've been together that long.
It's a long time.
And I think it did take a little while to sort of get used to the amount of time that I was gone relative to last year when I wasn't doing any school, to like get back into that habit. And it was really hard for me to make the decision to stay like in school and stay at the school and study rather than going home and like getting distracted watching Netflix or whatever, because what I wanted to do was spend time with him, but like you just can't always do that. So I found that more difficult maybe than he did, but I think part of it is like having expectations early, communicating about them often, and not being afraid to tell somebody if you're feeling neglected. like not being afraid to tell your partner if you're feeling neglected. Does that make sense?
Doesn't that then set up though, like, I don't know, if somebody says, well, honey, I'm feeling neglected because you're spending too much time studying. I mean, how much control do you have over the amount of time you spend studying do you have?
Well, they might just need to get over it. Or you, right. Maybe you can find a more efficient way to study or something.
Or you can at least talk about it, I
yeah.
guess.
Or you can be like, I'm really sorry you're feeling neglected. I'll be done in 2 weeks or something. Tough it out for 2 more weeks. You know, like,
right.
I don't know. I just feel like that's important. But we also, like, we realize that I'm always going to be very busy and have tried to make a big network of close friends and other people that we care about and are close to. And I think a lot of time that he might be just like sitting around alone or something, if he was just waiting to hang out with just me, ends up getting spent with our other like network of friends.
That's true. I mean, it's so important, I guess, for everybody to have a network, but the more...
And I mean, we're very, like, we had some friends that we're very close with. Like, I don't know. I always say I'm going to live on a commune someday. But, like, actually, maybe. I already have some friends in Seattle who we want to have a shared house. And I think that'll be good because we are all going to be, like, busy with jobs and stuff. And then you can lean on
right.
this network of people who are going to be right there.
Right.
Like, I don't know. I love that. I love the community in that.
So I guess one warning sign of a potential problem would be is if your spouse, significant other, whoever, doesn't have a network, a social network to rely on other than you, that might end up being sort of a problem. You're right there, John?
That's always a bad idea to never have, but what is happening?
John's fiddling. Stop fiddling, John. John's fiddling with cables. What are your expectations for pay? Let's just get this out here. What are your expectations for pay someday? I mean, let's skip over residency because we know that residents don't make a ton of money. They do make some money, so that's nice. But, you know, you're not going to get rich off of residency. I'm not even sure you can call it. Can you call residency earnings a living wage?
I think so.
I think so.
What do residents make?
Like half 50, of what 000? The full doctors
okay,
make.
So that's not bad.
So, yeah. I
you're not going to be living in no deluxe apartment in the sky.
I don't know. I joked a lot about how poor residents are, like to the extent that my partner got online and started like looking it up because he was worried. And he was like, that's so much more money than we've ever made. That's yeah. so much money. Like, so I don't know. I don't...
Relative to the amount of time that you spend working, though, I have a friend who's a ENT guy, and he, like, if you count how many hours a week he works, and, mm-hmm. you know, in reference or with respect to what he makes below, like, minimum wage or something because of how much... Yeah. How that much sucks. You work.
Well, and if you also then subtract loan payments from that.
Okay, that's yeah. true.
Then it's a real different situation.
Yeah.
I was thinking about loans. And I'll get back to the money question in a second. But I was thinking about loans.
If you
pay your loan, and I think people typically use like a 10 or 20 year loan repayment plan. And I think they get dismissed, at least the federal ones get dismissed after 25 years. But
you just have to wait 25 years.
If you're on a certain kind of payment plan.
I don't think that's how it works.
you have to be within one of the two payment plans. And I can't remember if it's called, there's one like deferred and then there's one that sounds exactly like it, but
canceled.
You submit basically like IRS forms for how much you're getting paid, and then they tell you yeah. how much you have to repay. And if you stay on that for 25 years, then they go away. That was my reading of it. I'm not an expert in it, but I think you will find that's true.
Well, but so there are options.
But if you pay a private loan over 30 years at 8%, which is about what a loan is going right now, so you take 1.08 and you take it to the 30th power, that number is 10. So that means anything that you buy now costs 10 times more. So I was thinking about that in the context of step two, because one of the step two tests, you go and you interview simulated patients all day, and it typically costs students like $2,000 to do this, sometimes more. So if you think about it, it's a $20,000 test on a 30-year loan term. So this test costs you $20,000.
This is such a scam.
So, but this, I think this underscores for me that, you know, without being too preachy or too officious, which I think the undergrads and med students and the learners have tended towards, we have to demand better. I think demanding, you know, asking, is this really necessary? You know, for, and if you don't pay it over 30 years, it's still a very expensive test. Now, that being said, I think if you look at quality of life, I think most people can have an excellent quality of life for like $80,000 a year. And if you ask yourself, like, what's a single or even just a couple going to do when they're like in their 30s with $100,000+ a year, sometimes $200,000+ or $300,000, or depending on what you do, $500,000 a year, really there's little room to complain, I think, especially considering the situation that almost all of our patients are in, or many of our patients are in. And so for me, it doesn't, like, my expectations are I'll probably be a pediatric specialist. They make somewhere between $150,000 and $300,000 a year, depending on what they do. They make about half to a third of what an equivalent adult physician would do. So, you know, for example, adult oncologists in private practice will make well over $500,000 a year. But for me, I would much rather take care of the patient base that I'm interested in. You know, I would much rather do this. I got a degree in math. I pass up ostensibly six-figure job offers to come here. And so if it was about money, you know, and you're competitive enough to get into medical school, you can go make more money sooner, faster. I mean, you're delaying the gratification of a five-figure salary for almost everyone who graduates college for 10 years, basically. If you go into medical school and you go into residency and maybe you do a fellowship, you're delaying getting $30,000, $70,000, whatever you would make for 10 years. So if you look at it like that, it actually is a much better investment, if you're talking about money-wise, to not go into medicine.
If you're in it for the money, you should probably just quit and go to business school right now.
Yeah.
Because you'll be miserable in medicine. It's really...
interesting.
It can't be about the money.
Interesting. I don't know if I can call it a trend, but I did see a couple of articles this week about people getting their MDs and then not going into clinical medicine or not going into medicine at all, but using them to, and this is very common in the Bay Area, of course, to no one's surprise where, you know, Silicon Valley lives, you know, going into things like medical, you know, startups that have to do with medicine and things like that, like fresh out of, so basically never going through residency. And then, you know, I guess that's where the payoff for them.
That's weird to me. Why don't you just do a PhD program?
Paid the whole way to do it.
Not a lot, but at least you're not
right. Yeah, you're not digging not the hole deeper. But on that note, it's sort of like go fail at three startups, and that will give you the same amount. You know, this is what happens. Yeah. Right. Most ventures don't succeed, when they do succeed, they didn't succeed on the first try.
Then
go fail some things and learn some things about life and about the world, and you'll have saved yourself hundreds of thousands of dollars, and you'll, you know, be better at it. I mean, what does medical school teach you about running a startup? Nothing. Like, nothing. Yeah. Maybe you develop a work ethic. But that's probably about it.
You probably already have a work ethic if you got here.
I think the only thing this is saying, this, you know, for what... in to the extent that this is a real trend, which I'm not certain of, I think what it's just saying is that there's a lot of startups who are interested in getting their fingers into the medicine, the healthcare pie, fine.
I'll go ahead and be annoyed with that because there are such a limited number of spaces and there's such a physician shortage that if you are going to take up one of those spots, one of those highly coveted spots that are wanted by so many passionate and qualified people, then it is your moral obligation, I feel like, to continue on and provide that service to the people. The training that you've got and the spot that you've taken, you need to be a doctor at least for a while. Maybe not for your whole life. Maybe you do it for 20 years or even 10 years and you're sick of it. But, like, seriously. Like, well, you can't just have everybody going into these specific medical training programs and then, like, going to start startups for funsies. Like,
I think especially at a public institution, right? That's a big part of the mission of a public institution is, like, the University of Iowa. It's ostensibly easier to get into Iowa and statistically, obviously, easier to get into Iowa if you're an Iowa student. And the reason for that is that's the mission of this school is to produce good Iowa doctors. And so while the question is, who's the onus on? Is the onus on the school to do a better job checking your motivation? Or is it on you to feel a duty to your state, to the med school that treat, you know, that, that let you in when you might not have otherwise gotten in? You know, pay that forward, I guess, or pay it back.
I mean, maybe a little bit of both, but I don't know. I feel like there should be a significant burden on the person applying to the school to really want to be there and to really want to be there for the right reasons. And I feel like the school does need to sort and weed and stuff, but like ideally they would be able to go into it with the assumption that people are there because they want to do medicine and take care of people.
Yeah, well, I mean, the other problem is nobody says during their interview, yeah, I'm going to go to school for 4 years and then, you know,
right.
Not only not do primary care, for instance, if that's what
there's
your
no
school
way to,
is
I don't know how to weed people
but then
out.
I'm going to.
I don't know how they're supposed to weed people out for that. Yeah, like people need to just not be jerks about it, I guess.
What about
like
hours?
That's ever worked.
What about hours? I think it's well known that, you know, the working hours are difficult when you're a resident. Allison, you're going to be a surgeon of some sort? Yeah. Mm-hmm. So what are your expectations for your hours?
My expectations are those that are outlined in the, I think the ACGME is an organization that makes sure that residencies are following the rules with respect to things like how hard they make the residents work.
And the current rule is?
The current rule is 80 hours a week on average over 4 weeks.
Oh, I didn't realize.
Oh. Hardcore
so, surgery. A bit of a loophole, isn't
it? I think that's I don't think that's what I'm expecting. I don't think it's unrealistic. And I actually think that people are going into internal medicine, family medicine, they're going to be working comparable hours. I think that I can expect to be working comparable. Like everyone is going to be working around 80 hours a week on average over the span of 4 weeks.
Is it really 80 hours a week?
I thought it was 60.
Mm-hmm. 80 hours a week on average over 4 weeks.
Okay.
What about post-residency? For surgeons?
I think it's probably less. Gosh, I've only done one rotation in surgery, but I don't think that I don't know what the surgeons do when they're not in the hospital. They're probably in their own clinics, but, you know, the people who take care of their patients postoperatively are the residents. They're not kind of doing the management of care after the surgery. So I think that surgeons work less, after residency than they did during residency, but I don't know by how much.
I think that's true for a lot of specialties, for most specialties, right? Though you would work less after residency. The idea is they want you to get as much training time as possible without actually killing you.
Yeah.
That last bit, without actually killing you, I think was added in more recently with things like those guidelines, but...
Yeah. What about... So there's... some discussion I've noticed about the future of certain specialties. For instance, radiology is, I think, changing in some aspects. Radiology is one of these specialties that may lend itself better to things like telemedicine and outsourcing, overseas outsourcing and things like that. I've heard of, you know, organizations sending their, you know, CT scans or whatever the heck they're doing to like India or wherever to be read. Is there any discussion, any formal discussion about, you know, say the future of pediatrics or the future of surgery or the future of, I mean, these are...
This is one of my favorite questions. I really like
good.
Science and technology. So there are a lot of things that are on the forefront. I'll put it this way. We have made a computer that can be the world's best chess player, and it will never be beatable again by a human being. It's only going to get better and easier to provide that. But 4 years ago, a guy made, and he got a PhD from a project where he made a robot to open a water bottle. So you want to see the huge mismatch, right? There's a huge mismatch in the ability to do a cognitive task by a computer and the ability to do a physical task, right? So it's going to be many years before we're able to build robots that can, you know, sink a 15-foot putt like Tiger Woods can, or can re-anastomose two arteries the way a master surgeon can. Versus, on the other hand, you have clinical tasks that I wouldn't worry as much about people being removed or displaced as much as I'm concerned and excited about expanding into realms that wouldn't otherwise be possible. A really good example of this is using computer algorithms. So IBM is actually licensing Watson,
right,
to oncology centers to analyze their data and look at things like, oh, okay, the nurse has this pad and it talks to Watson, you know, they type it into the tablet and it says, this patient is now coughing up blood, what's going on? And Watson says, well, I know they had this chemo and they had that chemo, and eventually it will be able to say, and they have these genes, and say, hey, there's a 60% chance that it is an infection, there's a 30% chance that it's, you know, a complication due to this chemo that they had. And these are problems that you can't do and you wouldn't want to do, right? Like, if I said, okay, there's 30,000 genes or 20,000 genes, and some of them interact with different chemo drugs, and also your cancer has different genes, different from your genome, and which chemo is going to be the best for you, given all of those parameters, it's like the most nightmarish Sudoku puzzle. You know, that's just, you know, it's like a three-dimensional Sudoku puzzle that's got 30,000 boxes in it.
I can relate to that analogy only because Sudoku is like the most impossible thing ever for me to do.
So what is a clinician going to do? And this is, I think, the coolest thing, because what's the clinician's job here? The clinician's job isn't to do the decision making in that sense. The clinician's job is to say, talk to this patient. We're going to determine what's the best thing we can offer you. What do you care about? What's the thing that you're most interested in? And how can I take this crazy tool set that we've developed and match that up with what I perceive and what I understand to be what you need and want? And so, I think that's
interesting. And I haven't heard too much about that, but what you're saying is the cognitive load of creating a differential, for instance, can be transferred over to, you know, actual improving the quality of your patient's life rather than just, you know, making decisions about, you know, what they might have. I mean, I know that you're never going to eliminate that cognitive load completely, but you can transfer some of it over to, you know, how can I help this patient? How can I help this patient lead a more fulfilling life? How can I help this patient, you know, just...
Because people are not going to want a robot surgeon. People are not going to want, at least not, I mean, just imagine that.
Not ask in the foreseeable future.
Yeah, ask it's your grandmother, impersonal. You know, who do they want operating on them? Who do they want making the decision about what chemo, when to pull the plug, when to, you know, all of these things that, these are the hot button issues, but we could take it into something more mundane.
Well, people don't even want self-driving, like, robotic cars. There are so many concerns about things like that. Like, imagine a self-driving surgeon robot. I don't know. I do feel like it will be a long road before people are comfortable with something
that. Let's move away, though.
Even if it's safer.
Let's move away, though, from, you know, the technological future more towards the, you know, future of specialties. So we've... You know, the you know, medicine is changing. It's always changing. The practice of medicine is changing. Is there any discussion about, Allison, is there any discussion about what the future has in store for your specialty in terms of, you know, societal impacts or things of that nature? Is that something that's talked about, or is it just like, you know, you'll deal with it when you get there?
I haven't heard too much about it, but just based on what I know about the human body, I think that you will always need general surgeons. I don't think there will be ever any lack of need for someone who knows how to remove things that shouldn't be in your body anymore. Yeah, I think that we're always going to need things to be taken out of us in as safe a manner as possible. So, I don't know, I think I picked a great specialty in terms of job security.
Or put back in.
You know, I don't think that there's a way to train them. To get less training and still do the things that surgeons do, besides, you know, the 4 years of medical school and the 5 years of residency, you know, I don't. So I think that as far as my specialty goes, that I feel pretty confident that it's going to be there and it's going to be a need for as long as there are people.
I would like to say that I'm calling it right now. Psychiatry and neurology are going to combine, and they're going to cuddle up real close to psychology too. Or at least they should cuddle up close to psychology.
Okay.
That's my opinion. But they're definitely going to combine, like, within my lifetime. John, what do you think? That's true.
I know I like this a lot.
I think
that's
true.
The one thing that I'm most excited about in that is back to that computer analytic thing. I want the computer to just know, based on the conversation that I had, what to put in the chart where.
Oh, my God.
And I can look at it later and go, okay, that's good.
That would be math
because
major.
how much time do people spend?
That would
think
be
about
so,
that 80
that
work
so
hour
awesome.
That 80 work hour limit. How much time? And this might be actually worth asking. How much time does that surgery resident spend in someone's chart doing clicking in 200 menus, rectifying some kind of order,
not looking at the patient?
Right, and so patient care has changed. It's not that they aren't doing patient care. It's just that the way that the patient care is done has changed. But I think it'll be exciting to see how things like that get integrated. And I think it'll change all of medicine. But back to what Casey said, the neurology and psychiatry thing. I mean, if you think about it, once you have this sort of hypothesis that the brain, that personality and all of these things sort of come out of the brain, it makes a lot of sense.
Mm-hmm.
And I think it's a pretty cool idea.
Psychiatry is already embracing that physiological part. And then you have things like embodied cognition where some of your thought processes or personalities or feelings or whatever are actually coming from more peripherally in your body, or like being, or are maybe not coming from, but are influenced by things more peripherally in your body. I can talk more about that sometime if you'd like, but I think embodied cognition is very interesting.
You.
Yeah? Okay.
Yeah.
Yeah? Okay.
Let's do it.
Well, I mean, so there have been a decent number of studies with things like anger, you know, where you feel your heart is racing, and then maybe you associate that with being angry, or maybe you associate it with being scared. You might, but they found, like, even if there was no stimulus to make you feel angry or scared, if they like give you a medication that makes your heart go faster, you're gonna feel one of those things.
Sure, and I think I've read stuff about like panic attacks.
It's a very whole body
maybe
sensation.
Maybe being a result of, or the panic that you feel during a so-called panic attack being maybe the result of some sort of physiological change in your body that you're just interpreting as panic.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Is that what you mean?
I think that's related. Yeah.
Okay.
And I think, you know, let me take it to a basic level and then use an analogy.
That would be best for me. Thank you. Bring it down.
It's like in the Matrix, right? When they say that your body makes it real. So you've perceived something to happen. Like, you don't know that, you know, this giant bird flying overhead is what got your heart racing. But now you're afraid because your heart is racing and you're going, there must be danger. Even if you didn't notice that that's what caused it.
Mm.
This becomes a really big problem in people with PTSD and things like that. Because if they don't know what triggered the situation, you know, maybe there was a flash of light or something. And they didn't see it in the front of their vision.
Minimally perceptible.
They saw it in the corner of their eye, and it reminds them of the time when they were back in Afghanistan and getting shot at. You know, this is a dangerous situation to be in for them, is what their body knows, and their brain will make that true.
Yeah.
There's an interesting, I don't know how much research is going into this area, but I heard of research that's being done to kind of break the neurologic pathways that set someone up for PTSD.
Oh, cool.
So if you have some sort of traumatic experience, if you get treated with a beta blocker within a certain time frame, that is supposed to kind of break the pathways that can get reinforced, when, especially when they're linked with a very emotional event, that can make you kind of have a hair trigger for anxiety or panic attacks or something like that. And part of me thinks that's amazing, that if it were to be able to were to work and were to be helpful. But another part of me thinks that going through trauma and letting it affect you can be such, just for certain people, can be very transformative, can be some sort of event that, you know, catalyzes the change needed to redirect yourself into, I don't know, yeah, making different choices. And so, I don't know, I'm very interested in that idea of being able to prevent something like PTSD, but at the same time, all the downstream effects of stopping some sort of lingering effects of trauma might, I don't know.
It might deprive you of something that would otherwise...
Human growth, right. Something like that.
It's not like they don't remember the experience at all. I mean, I think you can still learn from an experience, but the number of PTSD, the things that cause PTSD that are not a direct result of anything that the person themselves actually did, like, I don't know. I think it's much better to dissociate that traumatic experience. Like, I have friends who can't listen to certain songs. Like, so, there's a whole band that we just can't listen to when this person is around because of this traumatic association. Like, it's so interfering in people's lives and it's so painful. Like, I feel like there's no amount of, like, potential maybe growth in a handful of people.
That's almost impossible to predict, though. And I don't know. I just think it's worth... I think it's worth being very cautious about medicating away experiences so that you are more comfortable, which is what it sounds like. But I also am aware of how PTSD can kind of ruin your life. So I get it. I get the, you know, why it would be kind of an attractive nip it in the bud type of approach to therapy.
I think fortunately it's not yet a problem that we have, because I think it's effective in being sort of clinically helpful, but I don't think, you know, it's not like a cure.
Oh yeah.
But it's a really good question to bring up, because I think, you know, we're starting to get there with lots of things in medicine. And we're starting to reach this point where we open doors that create possibilities that we had no way of predicting. We had no way of knowing that this would be an issue.
Yeah, it's very true.
Well, I'm not going to take a break this week.
Don't.
Why do you hate our commercial not sponsors?
I don't hate them. I'm just not going to take a break this week because I want to go right into some news items that you guys have found.
Oh, yeah.
Allison, you had something.
I did. Two things that have happened recently that I think are pretty exciting. You're going to have to help me with the name, John, again, with that drug. But so the FDA recently approved a new drug for cystic fibrosis that is a therapy that targets the type. So cystic fibrosis is a genetic disease, and you can have very multiple different gene mutations and have the same kind of phenotypic outcome of the disease. And so the most common gene mutation doesn't have a therapy for it yet, or recently the FDA approved this new therapy, this new drug for it. And that's really exciting because... Gosh, because cystic fibrosis is
a pretty terrible, awful disease.
It's a fatal disease. Yeah. I thought that was amazing news. I'm kind of linked to the cystic fibrosis world because of a family friend, and knowing how this disease has impacted this friend and the entire family of the friend, it really means a lot to me that now there's this new therapy available to them. And even though studies show that it will only maybe improve lung function by a few percentage points, those points mean a lot to patients who have cystic fibrosis. So that's something that I thought was great news.
I was reading about this, and the new one is called Lumacaftor.
Yeah.
And the previous one, it's by the same company, Vertex Pharmaceuticals. It's called Ivacaftor. And it made me deeply sad when I saw like how it was portrayed in the media. Yes, it's very expensive, and we can talk about drug costs in a different time. But they said, oh, okay, well, it's only a few points. You know, this barely deserves FDA approval. But the thing is, first of all, we've extended the life expectancy without adding any points by decades in the last like 20 years. So imagine what we might be able to do if you do add some points, of percentage points of lung function. The other thing, which you can't test in a clinical trial, is what happens when you give this to a one-year-old and you keep them on this drug for their entire life. Then they may never degenerate at all, and they may look clinically normal through their entire life. Yes, they still have cystic fibrosis. It didn't cure it, but you're able to maintain normal function through the whole developmental span. Not a test you can do. The FDA, at least now, my understanding, wouldn't let you do that. And so, thankfully, those few points allowed them, for the next generation of kids, the next generation of people who have this, to stay on it. And they may never develop the degenerative changes of having CF for a long period. And that may prevent them from ever really encountering these problems.
Also, the nature of CF is, it's such a labor-intensive therapy, the whole thing. Mm-hmm. I mean, you have endocrinologists, you have pulmonologists, you have nutritionists, you have all of these specialists engaged in the management of your care. And as a patient, you go to the clinic, you're seen by each of these specialists. And like when you're seen by the respiratory specialists, they make you do this test of forced vital capacity to see how much air you can blow out in, you know, a second. The value you're given is like 88%, you know, or 100%, say, is ideal. And sometimes these kids, these, say, 7, 8, 9-year-old children, will come in and they'll do the test. They've been doing all of the therapy that they've been required of, that has been required of them, and they are like 2 percentage points less than they were a month ago. And it's so demoralizing because they spend like a crazy amount of their day doing chest therapies, taking medications, taking enzymes. So much of their effort and mindset is focused on not just like doing the things I need to stay healthy, but like avoiding the things that will make me sick, you know? Yeah. And so even if it's someone who's already had CF for a long period of time, I think those points are going to matter, because I think will reinforce the types of behaviors that really are the basis for survival for CF patients.
Well, and it's very targeted therapy, I assume, if it's specific to the one particular genotype, right? And those tend to have very low side effect profiles. Do you know anything about the side effect profile?
Gosh, I don't.
I think... I can't remember what it was, but we'd actually had some experience seeing patients. They brought a patient in our genetics class to talk about her experience on one of these drugs, which was the other one. But it was really, really amazing to see that this basically, you know, it's non-toxic therapy. It's a pill that you take, and the idea that is that, you know, it could potentially alleviate that hours of PT for these people, and it could at the very least make that more effective, make it last longer. And that was, I think, really exciting to see that. I mean, because it's so targeted, because it's been so well engineered, and the problem has been so well understood, that they're able to really make it something that's direct.
Yeah, that's a thing that I really, really like about like personalized or genetic medicine in that particular way, is that because like it doesn't help maybe as broad a spectrum of people, because you have to have that one specific mutation, but when it works, it really works, and it's really specific to that problem, so you don't end up having as many like negative effects.
Here's a therapy that really works. Scientists recently replicated a 1,000-year-old eye salve, which turns out to be 90% effective at destroying antibiotic-resistant MRSA. So the recipe is made from onions, garlic, wine, and bile salts from a cow.
Ew.
Bile. I don't even know what bile salts are. I'm assuming it's just bile.
Yes.
Proportion of bile. Yeah.
Proportion of bile. Anyway, researchers made the recipe as faithfully as possible, even using wine from a vineyard that existed back in the day. And it turns out to be 90% as effective, as I said, in eliminating MRSA, even in biofilms, which are very difficult apparently to affect, which it's pretty important for things like medical equipment, hospital equipment,
or things.
But it only go ahead.
Like things in your body, like a prosthetic knee or something.
Yeah,
like that,
yeah.
Or a valve or something.
Well, it only works though when all the ingredients are used together. They tried separating the ingredients and seeing if those worked, and comparing them obviously with a controlled substance. Only works when they're all together. So they're still trying to figure out why this works.
We're not good at that. We're not good at that at all in science right now, and especially in medicine, looking at multifactorial things.
Yeah.
You know, most of the, like, one gene, one disease, most of those problems have been found. Mm-hmm. Now, there's still work to solve them.
Right.
You know, I don't think we're going to find a diabetes gene. We're not going to find a schizophrenia gene. You know, we're like all of those sort of low level problems have been found. But there's also this underlying current, like everything new is good and the old stuff sucks. And then
find something like this.
Well, yeah. But I mean, so one of the most effective medications for malaria is, in fact, traditional Chinese medicine, and
quinine.
That was an old treatment too. But this one's derived from wormwood. Artemisia is the name of the species, and it's artemisinin.
That's
the name of the compound. And there's a Chinese, traditional Chinese medicine name for it, which I can't pronounce. But if you Google it, you'll find it. I think that's very interesting.
What good is this salvo? I mean, how do they use it?
Well, that's a good question. I'm not really sure.
Because
I think right now we're talking about lab and mouse models. Do you ingest it? Do you spray it on your the inside of your prosthetic knee? I'm not really sure. But the recipe is equal amounts of garlic and another allium, like onion or leek, finely chopped and crushed in a mortar for 2 minutes.
Does it work if they're GMO?
I don't know. Add 25, add 25 milliliters of English wine. Dissolve bovine salts in distilled water. Add and then keep chilled for 9 days at 4 degrees Celsius. And then after you use it to eliminate antibiotic resistant bacteria, you can add it to a nice beef or lamb for a delightful stew. I don't know.
Gosh. There's some label on the Lysol cans that say, like, will kill the HIV virus, so you can spray it on all these surfaces. It reminds me of that. Like, you have this crazy noxious substance that, yes, will kill MRSA.
Wait.
But
still your house smells like...
About as good as Lysol in terms of using it. Patients, you don't want to inject yourself with Lysol.
Wait, Lysol will kill HIV?
Something like that. Yeah, look on the spray bottle.
HIV is pretty pathetic. Air will kill HIV, yeah. Right?
What a wuss.
Well, I'm going to go home and...
Wait, there's the one other...
Oh, I'm sorry.
Oh, it's fine. Oh, just that other Huntington's disease.
Go for it.
Okay, so there's another devastating disease called Huntington's disease, and it's primarily a neurologic, like, degenerative disease. It's fatal, and it's genetic, so it's passed down. And you don't know you got it. Anyone who watches House is kind of familiar with it. I think one of the characters on House realized she had Huntington's disease when she was in residency.
Oh, House.
So you don't know that you have it oftentimes until you are in your, you know, anywhere between, say, I guess, 40s, 50s, or earlier, depending on if you've had people in your family previously had it. Anyway, it's awful. And they recently started human trials of a drug, a gene therapy in Europe, I believe. I don't think it started yet here in the U.S. That basically, I think it prevents the crappy gene, Huntington, the mutated protein, from being formed. If you don't get this protein formed, then the protein doesn't kind of like start killing other important nerves, neurons in your brain. And so the symptoms of Huntington's disease are kept down, actually. Very exciting, super exciting, especially for, I just got off of my neurology clerkship and I met a patient with Huntington's and met some of his family, and the impact that this drug is going to have on people with Huntington's is going to be extremely profound. It's just amazing stuff, but...
There's some amazing stuff coming down the pipe, I think, right now. I mean, there's just, in Alzheimer's disease and all kinds of, I'm just really reading about lately about advances being made in these areas. It's pretty exciting to see what's coming. That wasn't at all an awkward way of getting the last word. If you like what you heard today on the Short Code Podcast, aside from our audio quality, which I want to apologize for, if you've made it this far listening, we'll be switching back to the regular mics next week. But anyway, leave us a review and some stars on iTunes or Stitcher. Lots of ways to get in touch with us at theshortcode.com. But of special interest is our voicemail contest. So head on over to theshortcode.com, or actually, more to the point, leave us a message at 347-SHORT-CT, and I will pick a voicemail that I like and send that person a Starbucks gift card. The show is made possible by the strange world we live in and a generous donation by Carver College of Medicine Student Government. Our executive producer is Jason Lewis. Our intern is Corey Christensen. Our opening music is by Dr. Vox. And our closing music is by C2C. We'll talk to you in a week.